Cultures around the world have always looked to nature as a source of both increased health and wellness. While modern science continues to support this connection, we spend the majority of our time indoors. Welcome to the Nature of Wellness podcast, where we explore the relationship between the natural world and the human experience. Join us as we discuss all things nature, health, and well-being. We truly believe the future of health is now.
Welcome back to another episode of the Nature of Wellness podcast. I'm Dr. Mark Campbell. With me, as always, is my favorite co-host on the planet, phenomenal human being, Mr. Steve Otero. How are you, Steve?
Good morning, Mark. I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining, although I couldn't pick the sun out in the sky in this beautiful whiteout that I'm experiencing over here right now.
But you guys get some snow today? How are
you? How's the East Coast? Yes, it's nuking. It's beautiful champagne powder. I woke up to more than a foot, and I mean it's still piling up. It's just piling up right now. I'm very excited.
Well, you know,
how's the East Coast?
Oh, it's good, man. We've had a couple of snows here and there. It's cold. We mostly get the cold. The snow is a bonus, but beautiful winter day. Been trying to get out as much as I can into the woods, like we've talked about numerous times already. Just for that solitude piece. Yeah. Been in the water a few times. Still the only person I've seen out waist deep in the frigid Gunpowder River here. but you mentioned something a second ago about the whiteout and waking up to a foot of snow. That made me think we only ever talk about the beauty in nature and the good sides, but I mean there are some inherent challenges with waking up to a foot of snow, right?
Yes, most definitely. Right. I mean, obviously, as evidenced by some other areas of the country, right, we have to be prepared for this stuff. And if we're not prepared, we can lose our lives quite easily. Right? Mother Nature often wins. The human body is pretty soft and squishy, no matter how, amazing our gym time might be. We can't beat Mother Nature when she's dumping pounds and pounds and thousands of pounds of snow on us, right? Tons of snow. A lot of cardiac arrest events, unfortunately, that have affected a number of families nationwide, right, with the kind of crazy weather patterns and such. So, I'm grateful to be fit enough right now, right, to manage it safely. But I'm still sore. I still get sore. Right? There's a lot of snow to move around. And, my back is still a 40-year-old back. It's not brand new. So... I mean, it's dangerous. It's dangerous, brother. Avalanche conditions are rough.
Yeah. Well, that's a true story. And I keep going back to the idea of naturing responsibly that we always talk about and the inherent risk of living somewhere where Mother Nature is such a presence and so felt. And I think in the last few months, it's shown us that that's anywhere in the country or the world. I mean, look at places like upstate New York in the last several months, been hit multiple times and just horrible conditions. Tragedy. Lots of lost lives. And, even here every winter, we get multiple cases of cardiac arrest. As you mentioned, folks who are getting out and maybe not being physically up to the challenge of doing a lot of snow shoveling and moving. That's unfortunate. So, I want to continue to talk about nature and responsibly as a concept, being prepared for the climate that you're in. I mean, how does that affect the people that live in your area, Steve? Does it affect the demographic at all?
For sure. It's kind of a weird thing to say, right? I work in community health and community health services, as part of my day job. And, we have this sort of almost like a hidden homelessness problem out here, right? And people will camp or people will set up, a camper in a challenging, location. And that's because, right, housing costs are just astronomical, and a lot of people are single income, households, maybe they have children, but maybe they're a single income household. And that just compounds problems when the weather is really nasty on top of just the other standard sort of capitalist society problems that, we all can face from time to time. Right. But out here, right, we talk about, right, you got to have a winter prepared vehicle. Right. Your vehicle, it's smart to carry around a snow shovel, extra blankets, maybe some extra package, foods and things like that. I like to carry around like a jet boil, which is like a little extra heat source. If I needed to grab some extra water, I have that right there. It's not a terribly expensive piece of equipment, but it can be a luxury if I get stuck, right? Even though I drive a Jeep, but it's still just a vehicle. It still just could slide off the road almost as easily as any other vehicle. You know, it's just a tool. And like this morning, I was really like, I was kind of in a bit of a pickle and juggle some really big snow drifts and banks, on the edges of roads. And that presented a bit of an extra frustration this morning that was unexpected, but I was grateful that I had my shovel and I was able to kind of maneuver, snow around my vehicle pretty quickly and not be stuck. But, there has to be some planning, that goes into it. And if we don't know, we don't know. So we can't, we can't blame anybody for necessarily being unprepared. There's a lot of people that come up here visiting from states in the South. They want to check out our beautiful mountains. They want to check out our beautiful Champagne snow, like I mentioned earlier. And they may not have anybody that has gone out and taught them. And they may not even know necessarily where to look to understand those extra tools to help them be safe if they do get in a little bit of a pickle. And so I think it's important, right, to just talk about it and talk about it in a nice, a welcoming way. Right? We want to welcome you from the South up here into these mountains. And we hope that you're willing to maybe sit for a few minutes and check out our gear list, right? We're gonna have a guide on our show here today. We'll be interviewing, right? I mean, guides know, anybody in the industry knows, right? We have gear lists, we have checklists. We understand the environment that we're headed into, and we want to be as prepared as possible. So that way we can prevent, loss of fingers and toes, from frostbite or things like that. And then definitely, prevent loss of life. That's the ultimate, prevention that we want to have.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you said all of that. And I'm glad that you mentioned the guest, and I'm going to definitely lead into his bio in a second. But you mentioned on an earlier episode, Steve, that people getting out into nature, maybe for the first time or reconnecting with nature, it's so important to find somebody who has that experience, somebody who can guide you, who can give you that knowledge and teach you those skills that not only keep you safe, but help you interact with the environment in a way that keeps the environment safe. So finding a guide is critically important. And, I keep hearing from listeners who are pulling out different nuggets from previous episodes that really resonate, which is always fantastic. And that's actually one of them, is really leaning on experienced outdoor guides or mentors. And, another one comes from, I believe it was episode 2, where we touched on nature and mental health. And I know that we're going to talk about mental health and nature's impact on it a lot moving forward. That's really important to both of us. It's been part of the work that we've done for years. And, mental health is a topic that's been part of my life every day, personally and professionally, for as long as I can remember. I live professionally on the mental wellness continuum. Work I've done for almost 20 years has been not on the diagnosable intervention-based piece, but more on the proactive everyday lifestyle and being well piece. So we talked about how nature impacts a little bit. And I think it was more about you personally and your journey, and then the folks that you and I have worked with on the military side and how we've helped them utilize nature. But I wanted to pull this out because a lot of people have been talking to me with the new year behind us and mental health being such a hot topic. The New York Times put out an article at the end of December that was called Small Steps to Improve Your Mental Health in 2023. And it's going to be no surprise to you, but guess what was in the middle of that list? Time in nature.
Right? I hope it's nature.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there were quite a few different things listed, but time in nature was definitely there. And specifically, it mentioned the growing body of evidence that suggests that ecotherapy, or just the practice of participating in activities outside in nature, has a range of mental health benefits. Everything from hiking to rafting, they mentioned walking, even on a tree-lined street in an urban environment, has that impact on our mental health. But as we've mentioned before, getting outside and having access to that deep natural experience or exposure to nature can be challenging for some folks. But that shouldn't stop us all from enjoying the benefits of nature in some way every day. Right. Even if the only option comes down to finding ways, as our previous guest, Jennifer Walsh, mentioned, bringing the outside inside, and that biophilic design piece, really to soak up that mind-healing benefit of nature. There's so much research coming out every day that supports this. And me personally, one of the biggest challenges I've seen to addressing our mental health and well-being is the pile of unnecessary stigmas that surround it. And you and I have both been very, very fortunate to work with some of the, I'm doing air quotes for listeners on audio, some of the most mentally tough people on the planet with the military. Yeah. And I've worked with some very macho, machismo-driven populations in my career, whether it's the military or professional athletes or, you know, people in the corporate world. And there's so many stigmas around it. I remember one Major League Baseball player in my first season came to me and said, "Hey, everybody sees me hurt my ankle when I slide into second base. You know, nobody questions seeing me with the athletic training staff. But if they see me talking to you, then they start creating all of these different scenarios about my mental health and that there's something wrong with me." So that immediately dove in there and started talking about the proactive side of mental well-being. And, you know, with the military, we would call this left of the boom. You do everything you can left of the boom so that when the boom happens, things aren't as bad, or you have strategies in place to handle the boom. And one of the things I'm most proud of with all of these environments that I've worked is really looking at how to reduce stigma, and especially when talking about mental health and mental well-being. And the media portrays people, especially with the military, as like the John Rambo type, the
for sure
hardcore individual that does it all by himself. And yes, having worked with them so closely and getting to know you so well, I mean, I think I feel pretty comfortable in saying that those folks, if you know them on a personal level, will admit that they're only ever as successful as their team and as successful as the people that support them on this journey. So I'm really excited to get outside of the military world, to get outside of the athletic world, and really get into today another industry that has its struggles with exactly what we're talking about. And that's the outdoor industry, whether it's fishing guides, hunting guides, park rangers. I was talking to a ranger yesterday at a store locally, and we got on the topic of what we're going to discuss today. And it was amazing to hear that park ranger's take on this subject. So I think that this is going to be very well received across the board. And I think the more people we can hear talking about this from different sides and different angles and through different lenses, the better we're going to be at reducing the stigma. So, you know, I'd love to jump right into the bio here. You know, James Samsel is our guest today. Really excited to talk to James. He grew up in Missoula, Montana, and was instantly drawn to the outdoors. His connection to rivers was apparent from an early age, often set free on rivers as a youngster, and quickly learned to respect nature and preserve that resource. By the age of 10, James had taught himself how to fly fish, and he started observing the world through an artist's eye. I love that. In 2006, James began guiding in Oregon, pursuing steelhead on a swung fly faithfully, and continues to capture the wild places that they live through his paintings. He currently lives in Port Orford, Oregon, where he remains inspired by his daughter, Juniper, wife, Kate, and the natural places he calls home. James is co-owner of Humble Hair and Fly Fishing, an Orvis-endorsed outfitter in Southern Oregon. He's an award-winning artist, an advocate for mental health, and honestly, one of the coolest human beings I've met in a very long time. So, James, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you both for having me, and I'm honored to be here to speak with you about our well-being.
Yeah, man. Nature. This is exciting. This is exciting. Thanks, and, you know, as we said before the recording started, and we'll talk about the film that you were in just a bit, hopefully. But when I saw it, I immediately reached out to Steve and said, "Hey, you know, we don't have a podcast yet, but when we do, this guy would be amazing to have on as a guest." So this is something I've been really excited about for a while. I know we connected through social media probably about 6 months ago. We've talked a few times here and there, and man, your story is one that I can get behind 200%. And I wish we had more people like you out there making the world a better place. Yeah. So would you mind starting off just talking to us a little bit about your background? Like, how did you get to this point where you're at and what you're doing?
Oh man. How does anyone get anywhere? You know, it's
a journey.
And that's all it is. It's one day at a time. As you guys know, we're all kind of flying by the seat of our pants, just kind of holding on, you know, to that kite that's flying in the air. And you're just going, like you said, my bio, I grew up in Montana and my connection with nature was almost instant. Fishing with my grandfather and my dad and them taking me out in nature. And, you know, my parents worked a lot. And so I was always kind of on my own on weekdays. We used to go camp and my dad had a job where he was kind of traveling a lot, but we'd go and camp at a spot where he would have a hub and I was set free to go explore trout and trout streams and all that kind of stuff. And it really drove my passion. And we started fishing with, they're bait fishermen. They use fly rods, you know, with monofilament on reels, and they fished half a pinch nightcrawler. And it was a great way to find trout. But then I started reading regulations and saw the waters in Montana that we couldn't fish because we weren't fly anglers. We didn't have artificial lures and flies. So when I was 10, I asked for another reel and fly line. And I remember hooking my first big fish on a fly that I lost at my feet because my knots weren't sound. And that's when I started picking up books and reading and really educating myself and exploring that. And from that point on, when I was 16, my family moved to Reno, Nevada. And I was pretty bummed because I left all this prestige and blue ribbon trout streams. And here I am in Nevada. And what am I going to do? And I was instantly drawn to the mountains and started snowboarding and playing in the snow. I'd go up and night ski every night after school in high school, and weekends were dedicated, and it was always first chair and last chair. And you know, we started getting pretty good, my friends and I, and started to compete, and then eventually I got on a snowboard team, and we had a team photographer who happened to be an angler as well. And we hit it off and we fished together. And you know, I asked him, you know, his name is Abe Blair, he's an amazing photographer and you know, world traveler. And you know, it's like, hey, so what do you do when you're not taking photographs, you know, action sports? And he's like, well, I'm a guide on the Deschutes in Oregon. And I was like, wow, really? What's that about? And as a youngster, I had a handful of times where, you know, my dad plucked me out of white water because I slipped in as a kid in a sketchy spot, or was like praying that I was going to make it out of this spot because I've pursued the next bend and I'm in a sticky situation as a kid fishing, that, you know, I needed to learn respect for the river. And I was like, well, he's a whitewater guide, how do I do that? And he saw my work ethic and he's like, hey, you show up in Maupin in the small town, I can let my boss know and you can learn to be a whitewater guide and you'll get 2 weeks and either sink or swim, dude. And I was like, all right, well, I want to do that, you know? So I'm thinking about, what does Oregon look like? Big evergreens and pine trees and beautiful rivers and, you know, not many people. And I come over the crest because I'm not much of a researcher. I kind of like to just see where the road takes me. And it's kind of my style. And I come over the crest down into Maupin and I'm in the middle of the desert. I'm like, what the heck? Like, what is this? You know, where am I? And here's this massive, freezing cold, beautiful river flowing through this high desert. And I was just like, this is the Deschutes? I had no clue where I was at all. And like I said, you know, showed up, met the owners, started training. And within 2 weeks, I was swimming. I was guiding people. And it went from whitewater to, okay, I want to fish this place, to then doing camp on multi-day trips, rowing big boats with a bunch of gear, and then seeing fly fishing outfitters kind of rubberneck when I go by my camp because I try and work hard and make my camp look good. And that led to opportunities to set up camp for fly fishing trips. And when our dudes aren't fishing the home water where we're camped, you know, I would ask the outfitter if I could fish there. And that kind of snowballed into, hey, you should teach people how to fly fish. And so it started, went into that. And then one day someone had a spey rod in camp, or it was actually Abe again. I was like, what is that two-handed fly rod you have there? What is that thing? And he's like, it's a spey rod. We use it to try and find steelhead. And, you know, he put it in my hands and he said, be careful. It's expensive. It's fun. It's addicting. And, you know, I picked it up. He didn't show me how to use it, but I took my tip money from that trip and I went to Deschutes Angler and I bought my first spey rod. And it took me 11 outings on my own to like figure it out, make the right presentation, and have a fish intercept it. And it was that flashback to first fly fishing where my knots failed on the St. Regis River, where now I have wild steelhead on the end of my line and I've never felt anything like that. And I'm like, my knot's going to fail and I'm freaking out, right? And I land this fish and I look into this hen's eyes. She's probably 7-pound wild hen, you know, high desert steelhead, summer fish. And I was completely changed. And that was it. That was it for me. Wow. It was like, I'm going to pursue this for the rest of my life. And how can I do that? And that's how my guide career started. And the painting, you know, the art side is, again, with my dad, it started early age. First real memory I have is drawing with my dad, shape and form with a pencil. And I was always in, you know, in school, given special projects and this and that, and started to pursue an art career in college, but snowboarding kind of took precedence of that. And when I was in Maupin and I was guiding, I woke up from a nap one day and this guy, David Kinker, who's an artist, famous guide on the Deschutes and local artist in Bend, Oregon, you know, he's like, dude, who's working on this painting? And I was like, I was. He's like, well, I didn't mean to wake you up from your nap, but this totally sucks. You know, and it's like, I know it sucks. I'm like, thank you. Everybody says my art is good. And he's like, this is totally Bob Ross. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, yeah. And he's like, you know how this is his exact words, right? And I'm just like, who is this guy? You know, I knew of him and I was like, I've always wanted to meet him. And, you know, he's as high profile as it can be in a town of 400 people. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know how to use your tools, but you don't know how to paint what's in your heart and what's here. Wow. And he said, in 2 days, I'll be back and I'll teach you. And he took me outside and taught me with such conviction. And I just remember his eyes, how intense he was and how good of an instructor and teacher was and how inspirational that was. And he changed my world. He went over the basics of art, but he got me outside in nature painting, which was like the biggest teacher and continues to be the best teacher for me in my life, not just with art, but with, you know, with my guests on a river and all of that. And it just, that snowballed and that's all I wanted to do. And I started to pursue that and eventually left the Deschutes, made my way to Southern Oregon, guided on the Rogue, which completely changed my world. And I can go on and on about the stories that I have, but there I met this wonderful woman who was rowing boats down this river, bigger boats than me, you know, huge stacks of gear. And I'm just like, you know, all the guides on my crew are like, who is this gal? Who's this chick going down the river? Like, she's pretty cool. And turns out she really liked me. And we played cat and mouse and had a kind of a river romance where we would leave each other notes on rocks and little codes. And because we were on different crews, we hardly would see each other. As they're, you know, she'd float by, I'd hand her a brownie as she pulls up on the bank and make her blush in front of her guests. You know, it went from that and it quickly escalated. And we're like, hey, we've been working for other outfitters for so long. She's had a whole other career, even including in Colorado on the Arkansas on the Ark River class 5. And we just said, you know what, let's do our own thing. And so in 2016, Humble Heron started. And in 2018, we already had a child and we're married on the river, you know, and it's just escalated from that point. And there's a lot in between, but that's basically how we got here. And we follow rivers and we follow our passions. And now we follow around our daughter, Juniper, who's 5. And we're trying to keep up with her and introduce her into nature and see where it takes her.
Man, I don't even know where to start. That was that was incredible. I mean, that's like a novel, you know. Wow. Like somebody could sit down and write that out and sell a bunch of books. That was fantastic.
It's funny, you know. I tell people my story, and I can't tell you it all, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very abbreviated, very small fraction of what I can tell you. And people just they can't believe what's happened to me in my life, and I can't either. Because, I mean, I once told someone that I was thinking about considering writing all my stories down and creating a book. And they're like, he laughed at me because at that point I was like 25. And he's like, what can you tell? And I was like, well, quite a bit, you know?
You know, it's funny. I had those same comments when I was 25. And I was like, well, no, I get that and completely respect it, man. I love your story so much. And I'm so glad we get to share this with the listeners. And I know this is just a fraction of it, but even with the fraction that you can share, I mean, this is like solid gold, man. I love it. I do want to talk a little bit about the Orvis film, if we can, just sure. for a bit.
Yeah,
and I know that's the thing that, you know, introduced you and I, have some mutual connections through the Orvis company, and it sent me this film and we're like, hey, you got to see this guy. You know, you gotta check this guy out, and then turned into, hey, you should reach out to this guy. And it was a no brainer for me. And the film is called If I Tell Them, and I'll put the information in the show notes for the listeners to check it out. Brilliant film. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Oh yeah. It's weird. For whatever reason, I was given a gift to like see things in the future and whatever, that's manifestation or whatnot. But the Rogue River has, it's in Southern Oregon for the listeners who don't know where it is. It starts at Crater Lake and it drives 215 miles to the Pacific Ocean and Gold Beach. It changes face so many times, has a wild section. And it's like I said earlier, it's a river that's changed my life. And an example of that is this film and how things and river connections and all of that happen. Kind of hard to start, but just some background on me. In 2015, I was diagnosed bipolar 1. So I was that's manic depressive. If you don't understand that diagnosis, from swinging emotions very high where the world is very glittery and shiny, to coming down from that to deep despair and depression, thoughts of killing yourself, whatever that might be. It's a pretty big diagnosis for people. For me, it was a month long manic episode. You know, I was arrested 3 times, in pursuit of trying to help people. It can be violent for people. It can be aggressive. It can be very scary for your friends and your family. You know, people want to protect you. You don't want anybody's help. But it was a big life-changing thing for me. And that started, I started having hypomanic episodes because I had a sister who was killed. Her husband killed her. And through therapy, have figured out, you know, what my triggers were and whatnot. And it eventually developed into this. And apparently traveling is a big trigger for me and all of this. And so I had a point in my career where I had to take a break, and therapy was a huge, huge help for me. It kind of, it helped me understand myself and get through what I needed to get back onto the river. And that's when I found myself whole and found Kate and started a family and whatnot. And through Kate and through a mutual friend, this is where it comes into the story. Mutual friend who lives on the Rogue said I needed to meet this guy named Oliver Sutro. And Oliver Sutro is an art major, cinematographer, and fly angler, an overall good dude, and said, you know, you should probably meet this guy. I think you would really like him and be friends, right? And so I am pretty reclusive. I am, you know, if I'm in a run by myself, I'm happy. I don't need to be at a big party. So we're in Agnes, which is like, you know, 35 miles up the Rogue. It's in the middle of nowhere. And we're going to have a New Year's celebration. And I call Oliver up out of the blue, which is something I never do. But I did it and was brave enough to make a phone call. And he said, you know, I won't be able to make that, but do you want to go fish tomorrow, put in the boat? And I was like, well, that's more like it. Yeah, let's do that. And so we fished together that day on the Rogue. I think I ended up hooking a steelhead. Didn't matter. We had a good time. We talked art. We talked fishing. And at the end of it, you know, Oliver's very driven, and he's, you know, very matter of fact. And this is, you know, he's got a path and he's going down it. And he's like, well, it was nice to meet you. And, you know, one day I would like to do maybe a film with you involved in it about art and painting, but I don't know what the story would be at all. But nice to meet you. And so it's like, oh, I'm getting the vibe that I probably will never see this guy again, ever. He's busy, right? Fast forward a year, I had done a podcast where I shared my story about my whole manic episode in detail. And he heard that. And we thought it was brave of me to put myself out there considering all of the social stigmas. And him working in the fly fishing industry has had many colleagues, acquaintances who have also dealt with this as well, or are dealing with it or not dealing with it or struggling with it, and has seen how bipolar can affect folks and mental health in general, and even had an aunt who ended up committing suicide herself. Okay. And so I get an email from Oliver that says, hey, I'm going to be sensitive here, but I think I know what our story is about. And how do you feel about telling your story? It's kind of a big deal. And, you know, he was very respectful. And I said, absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to do that, because I feel like the things that I go through in my life are not just for myself, but for others, to help others. And I think I'm very willing to help other people out who are struggling or with an experience or a story. Because of so many things that have happened in my life, I feel like I can do that for folks and not sugarcoat it and be real with it. And so I said, yeah, let's do it. And so Oliver was pursuing this, and it was March 2020, just as the pandemic hit. He shows up at our house, and he's got another friend, cinematographer Michael Stevens, with him, and they show up at our house, and it's kind of a weird time. We don't know what COVID is and all of that, and rivers are empty, we're not working, and we start this project. And there's no script. I'm just fishing, I'm just painting, we're just hanging out as a family, and things come up. And let's do an interview and see how it all unfolds. And at the end of it, there's lots of hugs and tears, and it's not quite the end, but there's enough here to like do something with it. There's no sponsors. You know, Oliver, one of the last things he said to me is like, I believe in this. I believe in you. This could be a great story. The idea of the film, both of us, is that if it could reach one person and help them to go steer in a direction, help them shift their lives, whatever it is, it would be a success. And if it butterfly effects, even better. But in the pursuit of helping one person, that's the goal. And video production is extremely expensive. Music rights, color, all of that stuff. So he had no sponsor and said, hey, I'm willing to push this through on my own budget because I believe in it so much. I don't need a sponsor. Well, he then knows people at Orvis. Knows Simon Perkins, the president, and some other folks, and us being an Orvis endorsed partner, we brought the project to them, and they jumped all over it. And it was a pertinent time. It took about 2 years for all of the production, and you know, it was a very flowy project. There was lots of vibes, and it worked out, and it came together. And just last May in Colorado, we did our first in-person viewing of it at a festival at Five Point Film Festival. It traveled to many festivals all around the country. And, you know, we got on stage in front of 800 people. And the amount of people that came up to me after that, and the amount of emails, Mark, you being one of them, and the connections that have come through that, you know, I'm in contact with people constantly that saw the film that I've built relationships with, like a grandfather who has a grandson who's struggling with bipolar. And what kind of advice can you give me? And like having these really intimate telephone conversations with folks. Yeah, it's been an amazing experience. It's a beautiful film. I'm proud of it. And one of Orvis's biggest concerns was, how is this going to affect your guide business? So mm-hmm. if I tell them, is when do I make the choice to tell people in my boat my diagnosis and where I'm at? Will they ever fish with me again? That's kind of the premise here. So all that feedback, I've never had anyone turn away from me, and they continue to fish with me and actually pursue fishing with us because of it. It's been a wild journey and I'm proud of it. I appreciate you bringing it up, kind of long-winded, but.
No, man, that's beautiful, honestly. And that was a question I was going to ask to follow up was, have you seen any residual effects from the film, you know, with people? Cause I know that the whole premise is what happens when I tell people, right?
Yeah.
And to hear that you've never had any negative result from that, or people not booking, or a previous conversation that we've had, James, that I loved, it was when you talked about your personal philosophy and guiding, right? And I know I have quite a few people in my life that are guides or who have been guides, and that could be sort of a thankless career choice. And I know that on paper, your job is to catch people fish, right? You have fish counters in your boat and they're very results oriented. But, you know, anybody that has been out with a guide knows that that is not at all the point of being there, right? That's sure. That's the cherry on top, and it's not really what you do. And we had a conversation one night, I guess maybe a month and a half ago, and I left just my mind blown at your personal philosophy and how you treat your guests when they come out to the river. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that philosophy with you and Kate.
Yeah. Our philosophy, it's kind of cliche, but it's we're with Steelhead, we're in pursuit of a fish. It's a hunt. But it's really the overall experience. And yeah, everybody talks about, the overall experience. Yeah, we need to catch a fish or whatnot. But fortunately for us, Steelhead have a way of humbling you, especially when you're trying to, when you're trying to catch them in the most difficult way. You know, if there's all these different ways to catch a steelhead, a swung fly is probably the most difficult way to do it. If not the most. And so, if you don't understand that from the start, when, you know, how we gear up our guests for their fishing experience, if you can't grip that, you're probably not going to encounter one, then it's probably not for you. So that immediately weeds out quite a few people, which then puts us in a place where the river becomes a place for healing and connection over anything else. We teach people how to get caught or be chosen by a fish. It's not that we're tricking the fish. So our philosophy is very much we call it the Zen when we're out there fishing. It's more about, if we're right, the fish will come. You know, of course, a lot of it is right place, right time. You could say right fly, you can go as far as that, but it's the right place, right time, and right attitude. So we're cheerleaders. So, you know, when someone all of a sudden starts getting heady in their head about their cast and they're questioning their fly, that's where we come in almost like therapists to really figure out what's really going on. Because we believe in a vibration. These fish have a lateral line, right? They're in their environment and they're completely aware. The moment we pull up and we step in and run, they know we're there. We've seen fish regularly porpoise up and shift their eyes and look at you to observe their outside surrounding, because they're like, hey, someone's here. And it's about whether you're a threat or not. And if you really want to catch a fish badly, you put that vibe through the rod, through the line to the fly. And there's no way a steelhead will ever grab that weird, nasty energy. If you're in your head and all that, you know, when I step into a run, I know whether I'm practicing my cast or I'm truly fishing. And I know the exact moment when I'm going to get grabbed by a steelhead. That's because I'm immersed in nature. Mm-hmm. I'm in tune with my surroundings. And the vibe that's coming off of my fly is so good that that fish wants to connect with you. And we say thank you to our fish. It's you know, connecting with them is like, for me, the first time was life changing. And each time you look in a steelhead's eyes, who that may have been as far as the coast of Japan and have had their own wild journey that we've both connected with, and we both disrupted our path to then become, you know, one in a moment, is pretty wild. Yeah. And we teach people how special that is. It's an education experience. It's understanding the resource. It's understanding the water that's flowing past you. Yeah. So it's not about numbers. And it's funny. It's like, if someone says, how many fish are we expect to catch today? In my head, I'm like, well, you're not going to catch any. But the person who is like, I'm here and I'm stoked because I'm not at work, I can't wait to be on the river. You're like, well, you actually have a chance.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's funny that way. And it definitely what we do attracts a certain person, which we're pretty fortunate to have. And so we have built amazing relationships with the people in our boat. They're truly friends and family. You know, we're calling them at Christmas. We're calling them on their birthday. They're calling us. They're sending us packages, and we're sharing pictures of other experiences, and we're telling them that we love them, and we hug these people. And it's been an incredible journey. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. More about the human than the fish, huh?
It is. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it really has nothing to do with the fish. You know, eventually, yeah, you want to catch a fish, and yeah, we very much give people the tools to do it and let them be. Sit back and let them figure out who they are and where they are in this point in their life. Yeah. Has really very little to do with fish.
I mean, that's being a performance psychology guy and a wellness guy for so many years. I've spent so many hours trying to teach performers from all walks of life exactly what you just said. It's not about the outcome. You have very little control over the outcome, but if you tank your performance and your process, I can almost guarantee you that you're not going to have the outcome you want. Right.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, Steve, we've talked about that a lot. What do you think? We're both fly anglers as well. So this really resonates.
I mean, I only recently earned my raft guide certification, which is last year on the Arkansas.
An outfitter
right there, Rocky Mountain Outdoor Education Center. And it was just right as kind of a life goal that only recently popped up, you know, in my late 30s of you know, leveraging the teachings that the river has to offer me at this point in my existence. And I tell my children all the time, and I introduced my children into whitewater just a couple of years ago. I have a couple of 10-year-old twins, and I tell them all the time, I said, you know, the river never stops. Right. So we have to respect and understand that the river never stops. And so we, the human, are here to learn from the river, to understand the river, and because the river's there, and it's us, the human, that are, where sometimes we're graced with the opportunity to be a part of that river, to be on the river, to be next to the river, to understand the wildlife that's reaching out, you know, through the river, and whether they're flowing right in the river like fish are, or whether they're coming to do their little hunting, like some of the, we have amazing, you know, eagles and other raptors that come, and we can right sit back and learn from every little possible metaphor, right, that Mother Nature has to offer us out there. And to me, the river is so humbling, you know, it can overpower any creature. And so it's up to us to understand and respect, you know, our ability to interact with the river. And so you're hearing you share your story, especially your story earlier about how your relationship came together. It just, I mean, it makes me want to cry, like, cause it's such a human interest piece that, you know, we can connect through what nature has to offer, as long as we're willing to accept what nature has to offer, right? We shouldn't attempt to alter it. We should be observing, we should be listening, we should be feeling and understanding, right? Just like the fish with their lateral line, right? And maybe, you know, a lot of people who don't fish, they probably don't know that, right? That fish have these amazing nerve systems, and they have the ability to perceive their environment in such a unique way. And we as humans too, right? We have these other opportunities to perceive our environment in unique ways if we're willing to listen, if we're willing to feel what's going on in our bodies, if we're willing to listen and perceive with the different systems that we have for receiving. it'll really enrich, right, our overall experience. And it's not something that we don't necessarily define it, right? Like you were mentioning earlier, right? That person that comes to the river is like, how many fish are we going to catch, right? Trying instantly to define the experience, right? And to determine the outcome when really it's like, hey, we're getting on the river today. You know, what's going to happen? Right? We have these tools that we're taking with us, but let's make sure we keep each other safe, right? If you're in my boat, right? Let's talk safety first, right?
Absolutely.
And let's go enjoy our day, and we'll see what Mother Nature is willing to share with us today based on that energy that we're putting out there into the world. So, I mean, yeah, dude, I look forward to a day that I can come visit you, because I'm really, really interested and excited to hopefully spend some time with you in person. This digital medium is a wonderful tool to be introduced to other like-minded individuals. And I look forward to sharing some physical space with you sometime in the future. So,
yeah, me too.
Vice versa, you know?
Yeah. Listening to you speak is like, you're my people.
Well, and you know, we talked about this in an earlier episode too, though, is that, you know, nature affords you that. We talk about wellness. The social component of wellness is a big one. And it's one that's, you know, often overlooked. In the last couple of years, maybe we've paid more attention to it with the isolation that we've been in. But when you get out in nature and you find your thing in nature, whether it's bird watching or walking or fishing or what have you, there is a whole group and tribe of people out there that are ready to embrace you and welcome you with open arms, right? And they don't expect anything from you, really, except for you to embrace nature.
Yeah.
So, I think it was the first episode, Steve, we said, you know, the whole, if you know, you know, sort of thing. If you're an outdoor person, you get it. If you're a mountain biker, you don't have to go very far to find other mountain bikers, right? If you're a snowboarder, you guys are both snowboarders.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Fly anglers. I amazed every time I go fish, you know, in the parking lot, the easy organic conversations that come up with other fly anglers. You can always tell the people that are results oriented. How'd you do today? How many did you catch today? Right. And those are the shortest conversations I ever have in my life. Right. And I find ways to shut them down. They don't want to hear what I have to say, because I'll go into a long winded explanation of, hey, I caught a glimpse of an eagle today, or I caught this, or hey, I wasn't sitting at my desk today, so I caught a break, you know, and they're like, this guy's an idiot. And they get in their car and drive away. But the people that get it. So I appreciate that comment so much. You know, you guys are both my people. Anybody that loves the outdoor world and loves being a better version of themselves by embracing it, absolutely my people. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of with this podcast so far, is hearing from so many other, quote, my people, end quote, that are out there. It's amazing. And that's our whole purpose for doing this, is to be that mouthpiece for all of those folks that are out there doing amazing, amazing work. And I know we could talk about this all day. I do want to talk about a few other things, James. How the art piece. I mean, for people that can't see the screen, I know these aren't on video yet, but your backdrop is, I don't know, half a dozen or so of your paintings, and they're just absolutely stunning. And
thank you.
Literally after the initial email, I logged onto your site and was just blown away. And I've sent so many people to your site just to look at your art. How has art helped you with everything that you've talked about with the mental health piece and with the, you know, connecting art with nature and art with guiding? You know, you said earlier, you look at it through an artist's eye. I think that's an empowering piece.
Yeah. It's, Kate just, you know, I was in here in the studio the other day painting with Juniper and Kate, and they're all in here just because it was pouring down rain here in Port Orford in the middle of winter here. And she's like, you're just so much better after you paint. You know, or if you talk to someone, you're so much more you. The art piece of it all is, I was very, very fortunate to know, I think I was 8 when my dad asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, a musician, an artist, and a professional fisherman. He just is like, you just probably picked the 3 hardest things to become. I don't even think you can be a professional.
Yeah. What's that?
I still remember that phone call, and I said, guess what? I'm going to get paid to fish. And he's like, what? You did it? Yeah, of course I did. It's like, there's no other option. Yeah, it's an extremely difficult life path, and it takes a lot of courage. And painting is the mental health aspect of it is you have a blank canvas every time, and it's this daunting, piercing white wall in front of you. And the hardest thing to do is to start. It really is. And you really have to be fearless, because if you're fearful and you're closed up, your brushstrokes are rigid and not fluid, and you see the struggle. There's nothing more telling than an artist paint brushstrokes. And I paint with very thick paint and lots of paint. So purposely you can see my footprints and my past and my emotions and what I'm feeling. And the mental health piece is, I'm not thinking about process at this point. I don't know how many hours it took, but I mean, I've painted thousands and thousands and thousands of hours. I at one point locked myself in a room for 2 weeks and only came out to use the bathroom and eat and nourish my body to just understand painting. Right. Wow. And so that was just like 2 weeks of my life. And painting outside and feeling the feels and smelling the smells and seeing the seas and all of that directly goes into my canvas. And that's why I like to paint outside so much. But I'm not thinking about process at this point. I've painted so much. How am I going to create this? Or what kind of technique do I need to use here? That's just not a part of what's going on in my head mentally. It's more of an emotional deal. And I'm just hashing all my stuff out. It's like, it literally is therapy to me. Just like standing in a river, it's like therapy to me. I'm not thinking about my cast. I'm not thinking about what the fish is. And, you know, I am, and I do. When I get to that really juicy part of the bucket of a run, I'm like, all right, a fish could be right there, and I'm on it. All the other casts, you know, I'm just observing and feeling. And a lot, oftentimes, letting this out and letting the rest in, and this cycle of healing, hopefully, or coming up to a cognitive, the issue at hand, and why am I feeling this way? And I mean, it's really important for me to paint when I don't feel like painting.
Oh yeah.
That's probably when I need to paint the most, when I don't have the confidence and I'm scared to step back in. Hard transition for me. I have a huge struggle. I still haven't figured it out. Is what do I want to pursue more? And do I have to make that choice? You know, I've been guiding for 18 years now, and my body is like Steve, what you're saying, your 40-year-old body, I'm 38, you know, I'm feeling all those things. You know, you've been rowing a boat for that long. It's like, okay, how long can I do this? When do I make that leap into full-time art? It's a scary thing, right? Yeah. And how do I create art without the monetary value in mind and stay true to what I'm doing? And so I have this pull, which is anxiety in itself. Do I fish for the fish in the backyard right now, or am I productive and work on my craft? And it sucks, you know, to have passions like that. I'm so stoked to have passions. But when I have too many, you know, logs in the fire, it's like, what do I choose? So it all kind of comes together. When I'm with my guests, I'm taking photographs of them because it's beautiful. Yeah. And I'm inspired, and I want to paint them, and I want to give them that. If it wasn't for, you know, having to live and all of that, all of my paintings would just be given. They just would be. If I got free materials constantly, like, people would just get paintings. If I had it my way, I would not guide you. I would put you in the run, and I would sit there with my easel and paint you in this beautiful place several times as you went down the river, and hand them to you at the end of the day and not take a dime for all of it, because it's just what I have to do. And it makes me feel right. Painting makes me feel right.
You think we'd get into conversation about capitalism, but we're not, it's not that kind of show.
Yeah. But you know what I hear? I've heard that the whole time. Everything you've said, it's been, you've just, I mean, yes, there's some intentionality to it, but you've combined all of the things that make you happy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so much of a thing to strive for all of us, honestly.
Yep.
And yet I have to work on happiness every day.
Right. Right. But you're giving yourself the opportunity to do that. And that's beautiful. I mean, honestly, everybody looks at me with what I do and they think I've got it all figured out. I have to work at being happy every day.
Yeah.
And I can really resonate with what you said about you're better after you paint, you're better after you're on the river. I know it, you know, it, I get to a point where I say, I have to go outside. Yeah. I have to go fish. I have to go for a hike. I have to, it's not a nicety. It's not a luxury. I have to get outside and do something. I'm better for it. And the people I serve will be better for it as well. You know, so I can totally relate to that. Steve, we've talked about that so many times over the years. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking, you're making me think of my commute. You know, I have this commute pretty much daily from Crested Butte to Gunnison and Gunnison to Crested Butte. And we had this beautiful stretch of river in Gunnison from Almont down, you know, I mean, as far down as Mesa, if you felt like it. And it's not a crazy, wild, intense, you know, stretch of river. It's, I mean, class two, and really it's only class three for maybe a couple of days during runoff. But as I'm making my commute right now, even though we're deep in snow season, I still stare at that river, especially right at that point, this confluence in Almont. And I'm eager to get back on the river. And I'm like, I look at it and I'm like, oh, okay, it's too dangerous. I can't like go do a little run in my mini, you know, all by myself. Cause there's a lot of ice, you know, packed in the river right now, but I still have that tingle because I know what the river offers. That's just a little different than what the snowpack, right, might offer me and my feelings, right. And feelings about the world and the power to like sort of de-stress. You know, I'm a split boarder. And so to me, skinning is the part of split boarding that it's the most difficult. It seems to me to be actually more dangerous because I'm making approaches down low and sometimes under super high angle terrain. But there's just this sort of offering from the river that the river gives to me. It feels like a gift. And I know others sometimes will share that feeling, right? That sentiment of it's like when we're on the river, there's these little gifts that we can pick up on if we're willing to pay attention, that is. And I'm just so like, just hearing and being involved in this conversation right now, it's like, I can't wait to go get on the river, you know, maybe April, for me at least, you know, as the snowpack sort of starts to dwindle a little bit. And, you know, like I said earlier, I've only recently, you know, received my river guide certifications and I've been on the river now for off and on for about 3 years, but it was just this last season that I pursued a professional certification. And it's really more so to be able to understand, you know, how can I be helpful to others in a very safe way and to make sure that I am able to be confident with others on the water and to show them too, like, hey, I'm a newbie. I'm still a newbie and I'll be a newbie for years because I've got this stretch of river that I'm running, but there's so many other stretches of river that I'll have the opportunity to run in hopefully in the rest of my lifetime. And I want to bring others with me. I want to show you this new, exciting, fun stuff to me too. And maybe we'll have some new, exciting adventures, you know, together. And like Mark and I talked about with Nature and Responsibly, it's like this opportunity to teach others about these things that we already know, we all love, right? The three of us in this conversation, you know, we love all these things and we're excited about even just talking about it. But there are so many other people that maybe haven't been introduced to it yet. And any one of the three of us has the opportunity, right? James obviously has that opportunity through his profession weekly. Well, you know, Mark and I might have the opportunity to share with our friends, our family members, right? And those opportunities are a little more rare, but they're nonetheless, just, I mean, like just wildly exciting, you know, each time, right?
Yeah, it's a wonderful responsibility to have. Yeah, it's like the biggest part of what we do with guiding is that we feel responsible to connect people with the source so that they respect it, learn to love it.
Well, I love what you're talking about with Juniper, you know, and Steve, you talk a lot about that as well with your kids, you know, and we say this, I mean, I think we may have said this every episode, when you raise a kid in nature, you're creating an adult that will care for nature and make sure that it's taken care of, you know, and I just love that. I love in the film, and I should say, you know, the movie is like 12 minutes long, right? So it's definitely digestible. It's a 12 minute piece of your day that you'll only take from and be better because of. And one of my favorite parts is, and I watched it again this morning before we recorded, is just the interaction with Juniper. Mm. I just, I love it so much. And the fact that not just the nature piece and how she's interacting with nature, but how you're normalizing any sort of health or well-being challenge or perceived challenge with her at such a young age, you know, and you made the distinction in the film that she's the least judgmental person, you know, and I love that so much. When I was working in at then Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio with the amputation center and the burn center for the Army, that was one of the things that we tried to implement early on, was getting folks who had new amputations or were, you know, exposed to burn recently, get them in front of kids as early as possible, young kids, because young kids aren't biased. They aren't skewed. They're just inquisitive, honestly and organically. So they'll ask questions. And what we saw were these folks who were struggling with an amputated leg or, you know, bilateral amputation, both legs or an arm, and trying to get used to their prosthetics. And a kid coming in and saying, "Hey, what's that?" And you could hear the service members say, "Oh, it's my magic leg." And the kid is like, "Oh, can you jump over a building?" And they were genuinely, you know, inquisitive, right? And what we found was that it really helped these service members to be able to normalize their situation and to talk about it in a way that wasn't focused on the negative. Nobody asked what happened. They were just asking about the prosthetic, right? And it gave them a chance to control their own narrative. And that's what I heard in the film when you were talking about Juniper. And I thought it was magical, man, to see that and to see that interaction at such a young age. And honestly, she'll bring that empathy, that natural empathy with her as she grows, the same way that this situation for you, what I saw in the film was that it creates an empathy in you that you use to create the environment for your clients. And I know things that I've been through in my past helped me create this sense of empathy that I now bring to the people I serve. And Steve, same thing we've talked about. So, you know, that having that awareness of the challenges in life and learning how to see that everybody has a challenge in life, right? It helps us to empathize with their situation. And nature is such a beautiful medium to be able to do that and to discuss those things, because nature is imperfect, right? Nature has no straight lines. Everything is curved.
It's all fractals.
So you look at it and you say, nature is imperfect, but look how beautiful it is. You know, maybe I'm imperfect and I'm beautiful too. Right. So it's so amazing. And you've had all of these incredible outdoor moments that you've shared with us. And I'm sure there are hundreds more. Mm-hmm. Do you have one that's most memorable? One most memorable outdoor moment?
Yeah. If we have time to talk about it, it's probably the coolest experience I've had on the Rogue. Like I said, so much has happened on this river, but I used to work with a company called Row Adventures, and we're a travel adventure company and guide in 22 different river systems in the Pacific Northwest. And the Rogue is one of them. And a big part of what we do is connecting people to nature and what's there. That's a huge part of it. And so we did interpretations. And one of my focuses was on fish naturally. So there's a whitewater guide and we're going down and, you know, we're going through here and there and all that and seeing all the beauties and all the seas and all of that. And we get to a spot where we're having lunch. It's called Winkle Bar. It's where Zane Grey's cabin is. And if you don't know who Zane Grey is, he's like he and Louis L'Amour or whatnot created the genre of the Western as we know it. It's very flowery. Not all of his reads are for everyone. Riders of the Purple Sage is one of his biggest. And for us, that the one that hits closest to home for us is the Rogue River Feud. Zane Grey was an avid angler, fly fisherman, still holds a record for marlin, I guess, in Florida, and was thought to have, when he was out fishing for these big fish in the ocean, to be caught daydreaming about the Rogue and the Umpqua rivers here in Oregon. Big into steelheading. Anyway, has a riding cabin on Winkle Bar. And I've taken the group of our anglers while the other guides are working on lunch. And I go up and I read the first chapter around his cabin. So they have some context. Here we are. First chapter describes the Rogue from the mouth, or from the source by Crater Lake to the mouth. and goes through all the rapids and all the names of everything. And we've gone through half of them. So people understand they've got a place and direction. They're there. We're immersed. The second half of that chapter talks about salmon and steelhead life cycle, right? So I'm talking about the difference between a hen and a buck, or male and female, and how a hen creates a nest and disperses eggs, and what's the difference between a hatchery fish and a wild fish, and how do I identify a salmon because there's so many subspecies and this and that. And so, you know, because oftentimes these people are coming from, you know, like LA, you know, and I ask the question, you know, where does salmon come from? And, you know, kid will inevitably raise their hand and say, you know, Safeway, the grocery store. And you're like, well, yeah, but, you know, where do they really come from? You know, and so it's an educational experience without going too far this way or that way. Talk about dams and all that kind of stuff, and how we can impact or help. And so after doing all of that and reading that, and we're like, okay, let's go down to lunch. And as we're walking down the hill, here's his Mikey, who's a wonderful, great, dear friend of mine and also a guide. And he's standing on the raft, you know, putting his hand over his brow, looking in the river. And I yell down, hey, Mikey, what are you looking at? And he's like, there's a salmon in this pool. I'm like, rad. You know, let's stop here and look for a second. And at this point, these spring Chinook king, or what Alaskans call king salmon, are migrating up the river to coast spawn. And so they're moving, and hardly do they sit in a spot for too long. And so to see one is pretty cool, especially in a river that's turbulent and moving fast. And so we can see the black back of this salmon kind of porpoise up. And Zane Grey talks about the black backs of salmon. We're like, oh yeah, that's cool. Disappears, goes in the white water, is gone forever. Well, maybe not forever. We walk down to the bank, and I don't know what compelled me to do this, but I walk out into the run. I walk out to about thigh deep, and I turn around, and all my guests are lined up on the bank, and they're just watching me because we're all feeling something is going to happen. And you know, one of my guests says, what are you doing? I was like, I don't know. I'm just going to wait here. And this salmon comes out of the deep, and she comes up to me. I can see she's a hen, and pauses right in front of me and just sits there, you know, in like waist deep water or thigh deep water. It's like, no way. And I was like, wow, okay, this is interesting. And I was all, I am going to rub this salmon's nose, right? And they're like, oh yeah. Mind you, there are three commercial anglers from Alaska on this trip. It's a group of people from Hawaii and California and Alaska. Wow. It's a mixed group. And so they're like watching this, like, yeah, right. You know, and I'm thinking, yeah, right. I'm going to touch this fish and she's going to bolt. I touch her nose. She doesn't move. And I was like, wow, that's cool. All right. I'm going to try and just caress her belly. And meanwhile, I'm talking to this fish. It's like, I'm not going to hurt you. We're all good. We've got an understanding here. Right. And so I take my hand and I start rubbing her belly. And this is a dime bright fish, you know, like just fresh from the ocean. Fish doesn't move. I was like, okay, surely this fish is going to move when I grab her tail, or, you know, and I grab this fish's tail. And so I grab the tail of this salmon, which is about 40 pounds. It's a big spring Chinook. And she lets go, completely relaxes in my hands. Wow. And I lift her body halfway out of the water, careful to keep her gill plate in the water so she can breathe. And I was like, okay, now, based on what I just told you, what kind of fish is this? And they're like, it's a Chinook, or it's a salmon. I'm like, great. What kind of salmon? And they're like, it's a Chinook. How do you know? It has a black mouth. That's great. What else can you tell me? And there was one kid who hadn't said anything for this whole trip at all, kind of lurked in the shadows. He raises his hand and he says, it's wild. And it's like, how do you know that? It has an adipose fin, you know? And it was like, you're absolutely correct. And they said, it's a female, eyes are set forward, blunt nose. And I was like, okay, one by one, or in groups of threes, you can come out, wet your hands, and you can touch the lateral line of this fish and say, thank you, and we'll leave her be. And so they do this. And this is kind of an unbelievable, wild story that no one would ever believe. I have pictures of it, and there's a whole group. And after that, I go down and I say, thank you to this fish. And I let her go, and she just spins and bolts and splashes me with water and goes into the deep, and it's gone, never to be seen again. And it's just like, I call this the story, you know, the helping salmon, because there was just, you know, there was so much leading to it that she said, all right, this is your teaching opportunity to really connect with these people so that they understand how precious we are and how important this environment is. And, you know, the next week, you know, emails and letters started going to the head office saying, like, what kind of tricks are we pulling? And who's this fish whisperer, James?
The fish whisperer.
It was, you know, it was just like, you know, and my friend Mikey, who's extremely like, you know, spiritual and connected with the river, is standing there and his jaw is like touching the water. He's just looks like he's going to throw up. Like, what is happening right now?
That's unbelievable.
But probably my most favorite outdoor experience that I can think of.
That's one of my favorites. Yeah. And I wasn't even there. That's incredible.
Just beautiful. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
What a unique experience just to connect that way.
I don't even know what to say to that. That's amazing. Wow. Well, I mean,
yeah. If I can find that photo, I'll send it to you.
I'm rarely without words, Steve, you know that, but I'm without words. This might be a great time to segue into one of our favorite portions of the show, if you're ready and willing, James, the Fast Five. Okay. So we're going to ask you five questions. Answer as quickly as you can. Number one, where is your favorite spot to get outside?
The river. Do you want a specific spot?
Yeah. I walked into that.
Pickett Creek on the Rogue River.
Okay, why?
It's probably the most productive steelhead river or run that I know on the Rogue.
Okay.
Can't believe I just told everybody that.
We'll forget it.
Yeah. Don't Google
it's
that.
Fine. Everybody knows.
We're all friends here. What is your preferred outdoor activity?
Fly fishing.
All right. What's your favorite food to eat outside?
Ooh. Anything. Everything tastes better outside.
I will not disagree with you.
It doesn't matter.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Do you have a favorite animal?
Probably a bear.
A bear? How come?
I have a wild connection with bears. I have many bear stories.
Okay. Right on. And number five, if you could only go to one outdoor spot for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, geez. Probably the top of a mountain so I can see it all.
Oh, beautiful. I love that answer.
Nice.
Very so nice. We have one bonus. Do you have a favorite nature quote, saying, or idiom?
Yeah, I'll have to read it because I can't say it all myself. Favorite quote. This one is from John Gierak, famous author, angler. I think I fish in part because it's an antisocial bohemian business that, when gone about properly, puts you forever outside the mainstream culture without actually landing you in an institution. I think that resonates with me in many ways personally. And it's that fine line between, you know, we're fishing and standing on the bank like an idiot. So
I love it, man. I love it. That's one of my favorite John Gierak quotes. I actually have that one written down somewhere in my office on a post-it note.
Yeah.
So if you had one message for the listeners about nature and health and well-being, what would it be?
I found myself in nature and I continue to find myself in nature. So whenever I feel lost, I get lost in the woods.
I love that.
It's really important to be outside in any capacity, whether it's a park or a national park. You'll be better for it. We'll all be better for it. It's incredibly important to connect with nature. That's really what we have. And I don't want to lose that. I don't want my kid to lose that. And the only way that we keep it is if you go out and experience it and love it and care for it and learn to protect it.
Well, that's fantastic. James, I can't thank you enough, man. This has been just outstanding. I knew it was going to be great coming into it. I had no idea it was going to be this great. So thank you for that. Steve, any thoughts?
When are we going boating, James?
Yeah.
That invitation is open. Kate and I have a big boat problem. So if you even want to row your own boat, you can do that because we've got one for you.
Beautiful.
We'd love to take you. I so appreciate the work that both of you have done, understanding your backgrounds with veterans and just the general public, anyone. I appreciate people that want to help. And in the mental field, we all need it. Wow. We all need it. So thank you so much.
Grateful
for
your time.
Saying that.
Thank you.
That's humbling. And thank you for what you're doing. I don't want to sound cliche and say it's a brave thing putting yourself out there, but it is, especially in the climate that we live in. And the more people we have that are saying similar messages, the more we can start to break down stigma and have honest conversations that we've always had. I keep going back, Steve, to what Dr. Pettis said in his episode. You know, humans are a species with amnesia. We've, you know, forgotten that we all share struggles and we all share successes, and those honest conversations of what have gotten us here. Asking for help is what has gotten us here, and to forget that is going to keep us here and not moving forward. So, James, thanks for what you're doing. I can't wait to get out there and fish with you sometime. I can't wait to just get out there and meet you, man, and to meet Kate and Juniper. And it's just super exciting. And I encourage everybody to reach out. And if they want to have the type of experience you're talking about, I can't think of a better person to have it with. How can people reach you?
You can reach us through our website, humbleheronflyfishing.com. That's Kate and I. You can view my art at james-sampsel.com. You can just pick up the phone and call us. We'll answer if we're not busy.
Beautiful.
We invite you all, you guys too, especially, please come and visit us. We have an open door policy. Come on in, take up a spot on our couch, on our bed, whatever, a cot.
That's awesome.
Come play with us.
I just want to watch you paint, man. I love watching people do what they love. So that's, and I can't stress enough. I mean, we're looking at it. Just your work is, I don't know, it just captures the outside so beautifully. So we talk about bringing the outside in. I can't think of a better way than to support somebody in the outdoor industry and bring something beautiful inside. So please check James out. Thanks for what you do, my friend. I'll be in touch with you soon. And Steve, thank you as always for everything. Stay warm out there. And to everybody listening, do your health and well-being the best favor you can and just get outside.
Thank you for listening to the Nature of Wellness podcast, hosted by Dr. Mark A. Campbell and Steve Otero. Follow us on Instagram at Nature of Wellness, with new content being added frequently. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe wherever you listen. The content of this podcast is for general information purposes only. Nothing should be taken as legal or medical advice. The information is not intended to replace the guidance of your healthcare providers, but to create an outlet for new discussions with them.